Welcome to Asimov's Spotlight. Hear now another story selected from the pages of Asimov's Science Fiction Magazine. Selfless by James Patrick Kelly. What scares you is that you're losing control of yourselves. You need to keep them apart, crammed into their boxes. Remember when you were a kid, before you were taken? You couldn't stand your broccoli touching your mashed potatoes at dinner time. Keep those mushy carrots away from the chicken nuggets. To avoid tantrums, Mother bought special plates. They came with two small sections for the veggies and a big one for the meat. Dishwasher-safe plastic, pastel lime and turquoise and a sick pink. Everything separate, all in their proper places. Mother always said you were a trial. Your brothers thought you were weird. Your dad left when you were 13, 6 months after your one self was taken from you. You were Yosef back then. Now you're pretending to be Joseph Jiracek, someone who doesn't exist. Since the trouble with Paul, your selves keep trying to push past each other, take control at inappropriate moments. Husband, father, son, boss, one at a time. Damn it. And there's always the threat that the empty self will return, tormenting you with its overpowering urge to become, or else you might turn into the hunter again. When you wake up next to Paul, you're the husband, even though he's still asleep. He's close enough that you need to meet his expectations, even unconscious ones. Roll out of bed and step into the shower. Stare up into the hot water. Let it sluice over your face. No, you can't wash away the fear of losing Paul. He's at the center of your life. Being his husband is what keeps you sane. When he's unhappy, you're miserable. And the husband's heartache is seeping into all yourselves. But Paul doesn't understand about the money. Won't understand, and that makes you so angry. You're shaving when Sandra stumbles out of her room, and then you're the dad.
There's something wrong with my humidifier, she says.
Like what? Not wet enough?
It makes a squealy noise.
Sandra takes her place at the double sink next to you.
And it smells like the basement.
She rubs the cuff of her pajama sleeve across her nose. The fireproof fabric has princesses on it, one blonde, one redhead. From some kid movie, Frozen? You miss seeing that one, Paul took her. Ask Daddy P to take a look at it. Squeeze toothpaste onto your brush. She scrunches her face in the mirror like she's trying to find herself. You know how well that works.
Why can't I ask you?
Sandra is 10 and is full of questions. Too many questions. Because he's home more and he knows how things work. He's good at that stuff. Stick the toothbrush into your mouth, 5-degree angle to the gums, short, tooth-wide strokes, upper, lower, inner, outer, just like it says on the website. They say not to trust the internet, but you pick up lots of useful camouflage tips online. Adapt or be discovered, Mother always says.
What are you good at? Sandra asks.
Stare at her reflection. Pretending I'm your father, you say, around a mouthful of toothpastey slime. Hard work. Good one, Joseph. She carves a check mark in the air with her forefinger. If you had real feelings instead of the ones you fake, you'd resent this new thing. Sandra calls you by your first name while Paul is Daddy P. In the moment, however, you're relieved that your joke, not joke, passes muster. Except she's not done with you yet.
I don't want to move to the city.
You watch her eyes round in the mirror. It's dirty and there's no grass.
And Grandma's museum gives me nightmares. All those creepy paintings.
Nobody wants to move, you say. And maybe we won't have to.
We'll just have to see. It had been easy when Sandra was a toddler and you and Paul were dating. But now she's 10 and you have no idea how to be her parent. That's mostly on Paul. But with the two of them set against the move, you don't know what to do. You're torn between mother's illness and your family's demands and the bills. All the damn bills. You feel that dark self stirring. It isn't the dad who wants to protect Sandra or the husband who loves Paul. There's a you who is dangerous to this life you've made. Maybe having a family isn't working anymore. Maybe you should move to the city, just you, or run away before it's too late. At least on the train, you can be the commuter. You look good, even wearing yesterday's fashion. Brioni top coat over a bespoke blue pinstripe suit. Mauve button-down Tom Ford shirt. No stripes for your shirts because they clash with the ties that Paul buys for Sandra to give you for Christmas. This isn't a very difficult self to pull off because you have hardly any lines. Catch the train at the Glenbrook station and conceal yourself behind the New York Times on the way to the city. The headline on the cast-off paper on the seat next to you screams, "Psycho Doc Slays Nurse." The Daily News has catchier stories than the Times, and the photos remind you of your favorites in the museum. You're tempted to swap. Nothing like a grisly murder to distract you from your problems. But the commuter reads a serious paper. Change in Stamford. 20 minutes out of the city, the train passes through New Rochelle, which is where Paul and Sandra used to live. What would life be like if you'd never met? Empty. Pointless. Which is why you can't let him find out. What if the only way to keep your secret is to leave them? Pointless. Empty. And in that moment, the commuter, never robust, is consumed by the empty self. Panic then, because that's the one self you can't bear. You can't! And then, to your shame, you're the hunter. Shouldn't have thought about losing Paul. Stick your knuckle in your mouth, bite hard, and fight those terrifying instincts. It's okay. You're probably safe. Everyone on the train still sees the commuter. You don't want to be the hunter, but he keeps stepping forward. You used to think you'd banished him altogether. After all, it's been years since you've taken anyone. But now that mother is sick, stress, it's the stress. Got to get him under control. Maybe he needs to come out and look around once in a while, as long as you don't take anyone. Besides, you'd be crazy to make a move on the train. You wish you were crazy, that none of this was real. If you didn't have to worry about becoming the hunter, your other selves might almost be happy. You pick up on the smallest details when you hunt. The sag of a silk scarf, an untied shoelace, the honey of cheap perfume, a jiggling knee, the scrape of a cough. The hunter sees prey all around. Your throat goes tight. Why not pick one to follow? Off the train, ghosting through Grand Central onto 42nd Street. A man this time. You shouldn't fall into a pattern. But nobody nearby has an ammonia scent. The uncertain step. Twist around in your seat. Crane to look up the aisle and down. Where are the thin lips? Chewed fingernails. When the brakes squeal the train to a stop in Manhattan, you're relieved that none of the prey feels right. You find a way to cram the hunter back into his box. So, on to the museum. Snake through Grand Central to the subway and push onto the 5 train. Just an anonymous New Yorker one of 8.583 million humans hiding in plain sight. Get off at 59th Street and walk 6 minutes in the autumn chill to the white limestone mansion at 600 Park, where you grew up, where Mother still lives on the third floor. The discreet sign to the side of the double doors reads, "Welcome to the American Museum of Pulp Art." "Good morning, sir," Millie, the receptionist, greets you in the lobby. "Hello, Millie." She expects you to be the boss, so you are. Mother is supposed to be in charge, but she's failing. Millie is a pleasant woman in her 50s. There's gray in her curly black hair, a hint of stoop to her shoulders. She likes to wear flowered A-line dresses and pastel cashmere cardigans. Reading glasses hang around her neck on a beaded chain. She's lasted longer than any of the others. You like her because mostly she leaves you alone. But you know that if she ever discovers the family secrets, she'll have to go like all the others. Go as in leave. You're not taking her, no. Smile. Set to open today? An unnecessary question, but one the boss would ask. Millie is polite. Of course, sir. The museum's winter hours are 10 to 3, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday. Any last-minute sign-ups for tours? She hands you coffee. None so far. Black with a packet of Splenda. Look disappointed to keep up appearances. One of your jobs as curator is to give tours by appointment. But visitors are a nuisance, and you're in no mood to give a tour if you're going to be sitting on the hunter all day. Time to pretend you're concerned about Mother. How is she? Sip your coffee. Millie offers the overnight nurse's report. Quiet now. Scan it. She'd been screaming just after midnight, but was settled by 50 milligrams of meperidine syrup. No surprise there, but blood in the urine at 4:30? Not good. Millie is watching. She's still suffering, poor dear. Her stare nudges you to feel sorry for the old bitch. Millie expects you to be the son, but you lost sympathy for Mother long ago. She deserves her pain. After all your best selves are in pain because of her. I'll go see her. Thanks, Millie. Climb the stairs to the second floor, but turn right into a gallery instead of continuing to the third, the detective gallery, your refuge. On the walls hang the family's collection of leggy blondes and willowy brunettes, some startled, some sultry, a few bored. Weary heroes in fedoras reach across tables for shot glasses or pistols. Angry thugs glower in the rain. The room is crammed with oils chosen from the burnt palate of a dive bar, or all the colors of midnight. The art climbs the walls like bodies piled on top of one another. Work by Rafael de Soto and Mort Kunstler and H.J. Ward and all the pulp masters that had once splashed the covers of forgotten magazines like Black Mask and Ten Story Detective. In 1911, conservative paper magnate Jonathan Bulkley moved his growing family and their servants into the lavish but tasteful mansion he'd built on Park Avenue. Bulkley would later join the Man Suffrage Association, opposed to political suffrage for women, and his wife would become president of the Garden Club of America. You like to imagine what they'd make of the art hanging in their former bedroom. Once there might have been blobby American Impressionist paintings of seashores and girls in white lace, Bensons and Tarbells and Hassams. A century later, here's Mother's decor. So, Mr. Jonathan Bulkley, what do you think of this fine Norman Saunders piece? A gumshoe fires his gat as he ducks through a shattered window to rescue a blonde tied to a bed, her red dress bunched to mid-thigh. When you were a kid, you'd sit for hours on the floor in front of this painting until you'd imagined your way into it. Usually you were the detective, finger closing on the trigger, gun jumping in your hand, heel-crunching broken glass. But sometimes the woman, lips numb against the tape across your mouth, wrists chafing against the rope. Paul just laughed when you showed him the Saunders, but that was okay. He didn't know how becoming characters in these paintings saved you from the emptiness. Sandra just scrunched her face in disgust. But she's okay with most of the detective gallery, and likes some of the spaceman gallery, because she says aliens and robots aren't real. Most of her nightmares come from the soldier or the monster galleries. It's almost opening time, so climb to Mother's apartment. See, now you have an excuse to keep the visit short. Massive file cabinets filled with old pulp magazines spill out of the library and encroach on the landing. The air is sour with the smell of foxed paper, heavy with the weight of fallen dreams. The kitchen is empty, but there are breakfast dishes on the table. A plate with a smear of yolk, half a glass of grapefruit juice. Mother sits up in bed, perched in her nest of bedding. With her pale complexion and wispy spiderweb hair and white nightgown, she looks like an egg. Stare at her face. Even after all this time, you can't see what's behind those eyes. How much longer did she have left? Months, at least. Or maybe you'll get lucky. You see no obvious signs that she's dying. She'd always been a round woman, and leukemia had yet to pinch her flesh. Maybe the wobble of red lipstick or the cheeks powdered like donuts tell the story. She insists on doing her own makeup. Like you, Mother trusts no one with her disguises.
"Still here," she says. "Sorry to disappoint you."
So I see. You don't have to pretend to be anyone with her. She knows. After all, she was the one who took you, left you a jumble of hopeless unselves. Your father and your brothers had been one side of the family. You and Mother were the other. The museum's collection was hers, inherited from her uncle. The money had been Father's, and when he died, most of it went to Edvard and Tomasz. You two got the museum.
"Did you tell them?" she says.
"I asked them." She can't be bothered to understand about Paul and the family you've made together. Again. She sniffs in derision and picks up the TV remote. A click, and Kathy Lee is talking to a starched and relentlessly grinning man in a dark suit. The Today Show cryon at the bottom of the screen identifies him as Frank Tweeden, a televangelist.
"So when are you moving?" Mother says.
I don't know. Paul is pushing back hard.
Sandra says the collection is creepy and it gives her nightmares.
Pastor Frank Tweeden is preaching happiness, but Mother isn't having any.
"It is creepy," she says. "That's the point."
If only it were creepy in the right way. Mother's Uncle Grover, who you never met, had started World's Finest Publications in the 20s and had left Mother the company and his collection when he died in 1969. Neither the business nor the art have prospered since. Readers sought their cheap thrills elsewhere, and one by one the magazines folded. Art lovers these days find the museum's illustrations either ludicrously banal or offensive, or both. In the last decade, attendance has fallen into the East River. One by one, the funders moved on. The last one, Hiram Street, died in March, and his heirs aren't returning calls. The museum can't afford to open every day anymore, so Mother has cut salaries. Your salary. Paul thinks we should sell some of the art, you say. Maybe a couple of the science fiction pieces? He's looked up some of our artists online.
The man is a shithead. Good for nothing but washing dishes and cleaning your toilet.
She reaches across the bed for the collection of brown plastic medicine vials.
Sell all the paintings you want, her voice cracked. Sell the museum.
She twists the top off one and shakes a couple of pills loose.
But not until after I'm dead.
She gulps them dry. Aren't you supposed to take those with water? You feel your own throat tighten when she swallows. What are they?
Oxy, don't know what the fuck,
she replies with eyes closed.
First hit of the morning, thank you very much.
So, how are you going to pay the bills between now and the funeral? You shrug. Pastor Frank Tweeden has written a book, which Kathy Lee holds up. Saved from yourself. If only.
Maybe you're wondering how much longer I have left.
She's amused.
You're out of luck. I'm sticking around long enough to see you back here, where you belong.
You want to know the real reason I can't move my family here? It isn't the collection. It's you. She grins.
You can't stand Paul, and he thinks you're a monster. You should take that son of a bitch.
Mother changes the channel. Steve Harvey is sautéing shrimp with Pat Sajak.
I doubt he'd even realize what he'd lost.
You're at her bedside in two steps. Slap the controller from her hand onto the bed.
Like you took me?
She's not allowed to talk about taking, not Paul or Sandra or anyone, not in private, not ever. That's your deal.
You asked. She presses lips together, then shrugs. You begged for it.
I was 13. I didn't know.
So you made a mistake, is that it? How was I supposed to know you were confused?
You were my mother.
I'm no one. Just an empty space that other people fill.
She gives you her pitying look.
Like you, my lovely boy.
Pat Sajak's shrimp has turned pinkish white in the pan. They've cooked long enough. He adds the asparagus.
I'm tired, Mother says. It's past opening time. Go down there and do your job.
You make the rounds of the museum, noting who's looking at what. More visitors today than expected. Keep your mental attendance clicker. 23 in the 8 galleries. Maybe things are turning around? But no. Most are cotton-haired retirees. Overwhelmingly male. No future in the nostalgia crowd. The guy in the cowboy gallery is wearing an overcoat fresh off the rack at Goodwill. He looks like a homeless, but he has a museum sticker on his lapel, so he paid the $18. If only you could book school groups. But the collection would scar a fifth grader for life, and the casual racism of the cartoony Arabs and Japanese and Nazis isn't in anyone's curriculum. Bloodthirsty Indians and sadistic gorillas leering at captive women whose bras are falling off? Hopeless. You asked Mother to take you. Okay, sort of. She married Martin Jiracek, had your two brothers, and bought 600 Park before she was 27. She was 38 when you were born. The family was already splitting apart by then, according to Brother Tomas. Father had no use for the museum, and Mother had no use for Father. Your arrival just made the fault lines clear. So how did you come along? Mother had been taken the year before and was still swimming against the flood of expectations from all the people in her life. One night, she'd strayed too close to Martin Jiracek and became his compliant wife. She told you that was the last time they'd shared a bed. But having you gave her a dominant self. She became Mother. She doted on you, helplessly, obsessively. And you responded in kind before she tricked you. Her intentions about that didn't matter. Afterward, you came to hate her for what she'd done to you, for for the way you're still tied to her. Millie texts, "Someone to see the director." He's in his mid-20s, south of 30, with that boyish face, and looks as if he's on his way to some hip cocktail party. Check the clothes, meticulously fitted suit in a windowpane pattern, cut slim to match a waifish body. The burgundy pocket square is a stylish affectation. No tie, gunmetal shirt, collar buttoned against the neck. And the man, wide brown eyes, limp brown hair, a fashionable stubble which he lacks the testosterone to carry off. He holds himself too erect, as if to seem taller than he is. He's chatting Millie up, but breaks off when you enter the lobby.
"Cal Merritt,"
he rushes across the room to you with hand extended. "Three certain steps, four." Never stops talking.
"I'm throwing an event just across the street at 583 in December, and I've been walking past your door for the past few weeks, a month at least, and you never seem to be open except finally today you are. I have an idea for you, Mr. Jiracek. Joseph, is it? May I call you Joe?"
"I prefer Joseph."
"Joseph it is."
This prattling dandy arrives at your side, and you stare at his extended hand as if it might explain the mystery of his presence.
"An innovative business proposition."
Who to be with this kid?
"The director.
Mother is dying, so you're playing the director of the American Museum of Pulp Art."
"Sorry."
Take his hand. Merritt is a gripper. "We've switched over to winter hours, Wednesday, Thursday."
Yeah, I read the sign."
He lets you go and slips a hand into his jacket pocket.
"But in late October? Seems like jumping the gun on the season. The streets are still full of customers."
He produces a business card.
"I'm with Forward. We're finalizing plans for our convocation, and we're looking for something for the art piece. I think the stuff you have here will speak to our membership, Joseph. And you're so convenient."
Convocation? What did Merritt know about their stuff if he'd never been in the museum?
"Let's walk, and I'll fill you in with our thinking. You've been to 583, yes? Brick, with all the columns?"
He points downtown.
"The dome with the lantern."
"The old Christian Science building." Lead him toward the grand stairway. "I grew up here."
"Here in the Upper East Side?" Merritt does a double take. "Wait, are you talking about here? He chuckles. You grew up in a museum?"
"There's an apartment on the third floor."
"Serious dedication to the cause, Joseph."
The kid's amusement rankles you.
"Above and way beyond."
He takes the stairs two at a time. As you follow at your own pace, you feel the hunter stir. Merritt hesitates on the landing.
"So I've been all over your website. I'm interested in your cowboy and sports hero collections, but I want to start in the spaceman room. Have you got any Frank R. Paul or Virgil Finlay? Frazetta?"
"No, Paul, but Finlay interior." "This way." You show him. "It's black and white, of course, the Finlay. Rosetta was drawing comics during the classic pulp magazine era. His barbarian work, Conan and Burroughs and the like, doesn't come until the 60s. But we've got some first-rate Earl Burgies and early Kelly Freas." At the entrance to the Spaceman Gallery, you turn and block him. "You say you're interested, Mr. Merritt? Interested in what?"
"I want to borrow some of your paintings."
Merritt peers past you at the Alex Schomburg on the far wall.
"Rent them for a few days, or whatever you want to call it."
Your heart sinks as he brushes past. Mother will never let the art leave the building. The kid takes his time, moving counterclockwise through the room. You have to admit, he has taste. He slights the Wesso and lingers with the Empsch. Paintings that feature the human figure catch his eye, while spaceships and robots and alien landscapes fail to hold him. It's just afternoon, and you're in the pin-up room, and he's still at it. Museum usually empties out at lunchtime. It might help attendance if you had a cafeteria, but investing in a kitchen and a dining room and a license and the insurance has never made sense. You two are the only people in the gallery now, maybe on the floor. It's a waste of your time. So send him away already. The charade is pointless. The museum is hopeless, and the hunter is scratching to get out. The room gets brighter, and the floor seems to tilt toward Merritt. You catch a step, trying to regain balance. He smells like prey. He does. No, you're the director, and you know it would be crazy to take someone here, in this public space, in your museum. But a toxic mix of shame and anger and despair threatens to overwhelm that unhappy self. And then Merritt is by your side.
Are you all right, Joseph?
He's too close, and there's something off in his expression. Not concern, resolve, as if he's reached a decision. When he puts his right arm around your shoulder, the hunter springs forward, flinging the director aside. But before you can twitch out of Merritt's grasp for the take, he places his left hand against your forehead, palm against hot skin, fingers clutching hair. What's he doing? You claw at the kid's hand and reach to take him. Go, go, do it. But in that moment, you, both the hunter and Merritt, are struck by a surge of mirroring physical repulsion, and you fly apart like the poles of two magnets. Merritt slumps to his knees. You catch yourself against the wall. The hunter, gone. Forever? You can't tell. Your mind is stone, your thoughts too heavy to lift to consciousness. Your lungs breathe and your heart pumps without you. You're empty, but you can't imagine a self. Any self to become. What brings you back to the room is laughter. Someone is laughing? Is it you? No. The kid thinks this is funny. He leans to one side on the floor, and you worry he might topple over. Then he presses a hand to steady himself, gets one leg under him, and rises.
Never had that happen before.
He's grinning.
Well played, sir.
Then you get the joke. It's impossible, but the only explanation. You've already been taken, you say.
We call it gathered, he says. Gathered into the light.
When Lois the server comes back, Merritt orders tapas to go with his pint of coffee porter.
I'll have the blistered shishito peppers and the lacquered pork belly bites.
He glances over at you.
Sure you don't want anything? It's on me.
Everything about him annoys you now, including the way he orders dishes exactly as they are written up on the menu. Not peppers, but
blistered shishito peppers.
And who drinks coffee-flavored beer?
I'm fine with this.
You wrap a hand tight around your Diet Coke to keep it from jumping off the table and splashing in Merritt's face. You accepted the invitation for drinks and a chat after the museum closed, even though all you really want to do now is catch the first train home and lock yourself in a closet. At least you don't have to be anyone with Merritt. Still, the waitresses notice, and random glances from other customers tug you in different directions.
Concentrate.
None of yourselves would ever choose a noisy, crowded place like this. Over at the bar, the drinkers stand too deep and shout orders at the bartender. Is this where people Merritt's age go to hook up? Or do people like him even bother? What does it mean to be gathered?
So I totally get where you're coming from on this, Merritt says. But I want you to realize we have a different perspective on our way of being. A way that we share, Joseph. Of course, where you started from and where we start from are very, very different. And the starting point affects the journey, yes? But I have to believe we're on the same path.
You came home from school that day, crying. You were still Yosef then. Yosef Yerasek, the kid with the funny name. A 13-year-old boy wasn't supposed to cry, and you never had before, even after the bullies called you jizz breath, or when your friends said your clothes were weird, or that you sucked at sports. But when Jenny Bolateri called you a homo, and then a chorus of her stuck-up friends had taunted you outside the Wagner Middle School, you had no way to stop the tears. Mother tried to comfort you with a cuddle, but her embrace never seemed more distant, as if she were trying to push you away even as she clutched you to her. She said she was proud of you. She said you shouldn't worry about what other people thought. Her advice was to do whatever you had to do to get along with your classmates, because you'd be in high school next year. You swiped at your eyes. You told her you couldn't wait, couldn't get along. You'd never known how, never would. You can still see the crumpled look on her face when she said she could make things better, make you not care, if you wanted, if you really, really wanted. And you said yes, your voice like steel wool in your throat. Yes, please, yes. And she was helpless to refuse, because you had that power over her. She had to be your mother. That was the day you started narrating, helps you make sense of this life. The server delivers the peppers and the pork belly. Can I get you anything else? She asks.
Another of the same, Lois. Merritt taps his almost empty glass. If you please.
When Lois glances at your untouched Diet Coke, you wave her off.
Now these peppers, he says, are one beautiful, beautiful snack. So easy to make.
Picks up one by the stem to admire it.
You saute them in a little olive oil until you get a bit of char here and there, some sea salt, just a squeeze of fresh lemon, slide them into a bowl, and table them.
He bites off most of the pepper and drops the remaining stem onto his appetizer plate.
Every so often you get a hot one, but otherwise they're pretty mild.
He fixes you with his ever-confident stare.
You should join us, Joseph, regardless of what your mother decides about the paintings, although I think once you bring her the good news about the gathered, she'll be happy to help us out.
Mother made you kneel in front of her when she took you, so she could set her hand just so on your head, the same way Merritt had before you tried to take him. Her palm pressed to your hairline, fingers splayed. Her skin was not sticky, tacky, like dough. You rolled your eyes as high as possible to see what she was doing. Was it your imagination that her hand flattened and stretched until it covered your head like a kind of fleshy cap? That her middle three fingers curled right to the base of your occipital bulge while her thumb and pinky tickled your ear canals? When they slithered in, all you could hear was your own breathing as she pressed deeper and deeper in until she touched your brain. No, that didn't happen. But that's what it felt like. You wanted to shake your head, expel her icy electric fingertips. They were freezing your memory and searing your emotions away, leaving you, what? Empty. When she withdrew, you realized there was no Yosef Yerasek. So, nobody needed to cry.
I mean, it's kind of like what the Buddha was talking about, Merritt says. If you think about it, lots of us have converted to Buddhism.
That doesn't make any sense. You shake your head. Who converts? There is no us. We're just a collection of behaviors.
Okay, let me see if I can get this straight.
He taps the side of his head as if to jiggle the memory loose.
We have people who are better at explaining, but I'm willing to give it a go.
He shuffles his stool around the round high top, getting closer to you. Apparently his secrets must be murmured.
You're caught in the language trap, Joseph, but the map is not the territory. Do you know that saying? The problem is the verb to be.
He pauses as if he has asked you a question and is waiting for an answer. Not for him to continue.
To be is the gnarliest verb in English. Totally irregular, right? Am, is, are, was, were, being, been. I mean, what the fuck? Regular verbs change through suffixes. I talk, he talks, we talked. There's no we are-ed or I am-ed. It's because to be was built from a lot of different words, other really old ideas that got stitched together. A Frankenstein verb. He chuckles at his little joke. You sip Diet Coke. So there was this ancient language 6,000 or 7,000 years ago called PIE, P-I-E. That's an acronym. It stands for Proto-Indo-European. He makes a gun with his thumb and forefinger and shoots approval at you. So, one of the roots of to be in Pi is beu, B-E-U, which means to be, to grow, to become. We get be and been from it. Another is wes, W-E-S, which means remain or abide or live. It gives us was and were. Then there's as, A-S. That's where is and am and are come from. It means to exist. Are you with me so far? Strangers bump past, looking for other strangers. You're sweating. Maybe. You hate to sweat. Depends where we're going with this. Here it is. This is the contradiction built into all language, Joseph. It doesn't always map onto reality. He forks up a pork belly bite. When they say, I am, he nods at the people clamoring for drinks. They're convinced that they're referring to a self that exists and has a kind of permanence. It remains and abides, whatever. But to be implies becoming, growing, change, get it? And we know this is true. They're not the same people they were last year or even yesterday, mentally and physically. The human body totally replaces itself every 7 years, bone and blood and not neurons. That seven-year thing is pure urban legend. No, not neurons. But the pathways between neurons? He snaps his fingers. Reroute all the time. Ever heard of brain plasticity? You have to cut him off before he launches into another lecture. So how often do you do this thing? Gather people? Not very often. He drinks his porter. And only after training, and only if they ask. We have to be careful, as you well know, about revealing ourselves. The others wouldn't understand. He gives a careless salute to the restaurant's other customers. But as I said, we thought you were one of us, although nobody could vouch for when and where you were gathered. When I offered you the sign of welcome, I tried to take you. Take? Right. The word curdles on his tongue. Your language might be tripping you up on that one, my friend. Kind of pathological, if you don't mind my saying. Maybe that's the way you were taught, but it isn't the way it is. When we gather new members, it has to be voluntary. We believe we're giving them a gift. And, as I said, there's lots of explanation involved. Guidance, he chuckles. In any event, you can't take what isn't there. But you gave me a shock, I have to say. He presses a hand to his chest. Felt like a heart attack. Let's not do that again, okay? Pathological. The word cuts you. You won't be telling him about the hunter, how you took three people, two men and a woman, all those years ago. There were no witnesses, and you ran away, leaving them to fend for themselves afterward. You were sick with excitement when you did it, sick with shame afterward. So why do it? You told yourself it was because of what you'd become, the way you imagined yourself into that Margaret Brundage vampire painting from Weird Tales, some kind of personality ghoul with the psychic urge to feed. But Mother never took anyone but you, and the gathered don't hunt. So you people know how this is all supposed to work, you say, which means I'm saved. You squirm on the uncomfortable stool, your feet dangling just above the floor. Gathered. You're tired is what you are. Merritt gives you a sympathetic pat on the arm and scoots back to the opposite side of the table. This is a lot to take in, Joseph, I know. Your head is full of language just now, and not all of it is working for you. Look, when people name something, they expect it to stay the way it was when they named it. Language does fine when it's talking about a table. He wraps knuckles next to his plate. Tables don't change into chairs or butterflies. But it doesn't work when it's about you and I, or them either. We know that the continuous self is an illusion. Our way of being isn't a handicap, despite what your mother raised you to believe. So, go home. Think things over. We'll talk again soon.
You'd like to think that it was because of her that you took those three innocent people. But was she really the one who made you what you are? Maybe losing herself left her bitter, angry even. But she didn't inflict her emptiness on the rest of the world. Just on you, and only out of love. The server has taken Merritt's knock as a signal for the check, because here she is, holding a tablet out to them. Who's the lucky one?
I'll take that. He inserts an American Express card into the chip reader. You notice that he taps the 20% button on the suggested tip screen.
Yummy as always, Lois.
He tucks the card back into his wallet.
Tell Brian the shishitos were blistered just right this time.
Thanks, Merritt. She beams at him. I will. Have a nice day, gentlemen. As you watch her leave, you wonder if this place is where all the newly gathered receive their first briefing.
Merritt slips off his stool and waits, a smile twitching at the corners of his mouth. You were feeling antsy just a moment ago, but now that it's time to go, you're stuck to your stool. No way you're ready to face the world beyond this table. He's right. Your head is filled with language, and it's weighing you down. So you stretch for the floor, and the room seems to spin. Catch yourself against the table as you stand.
Is that it?
He laughs.
Like Bill Clinton said, depends on what the meaning of the word is.
You should have remembered that Paul has his classic book club tonight. How could you forget? He's been whining all week about how self-indulgent and boring On the Road is, and wondering who the hell had told Kerouac he could write. But the moment you step through the front door and there's no sweet fragrance of dinner, you know you and Sandra are on your own. Normally, you order takeout on book club night. You call Sandra from the train and stop, or beef bibimbap, or chili relleno, or a pepperoni and olive pizza. But tonight you're empty-handed, and Sandra is excited to try out some recipes she's learned in the Kids Make Breakfast class she's been taking after school with her friend Shanice.
I'm the top chef, she says. As your punishment for forgetting, I'm making you the bottom chef.
She hands you Paul's apron, the one that reads, "Your opinion was not in the recipe." You're not in the mood for this, but easier to pretend to be her helper than pretending to be her dad. Become a robot, take direction, worry about the gathered and Paul and the rest of your life later, after she goes to bed. But I'm the world's worst cook, you say. None of your excuses. She pulls one of the kitchen chairs next to the oven and climbs onto it so that she can be at eye level to give him orders. You'll be okay as long as you do everything exactly the way I tell you to.
Everything?
Cringe and play along.
Everything about cooking.
She flips the screens on the iPhone you gave her for her 10th birthday.
First, we are going to make my famous banana coconut muffin supreme. So you're going to need...
Coconut, you say? Banana?
You take this seriously if you want to keep your job, Mr. Jirasek. Are we clear?
You need to bring me, she reads from the screen,
flour, sugar, baking powder, baking soda, butter, eggs, milk, and vanilla extract. You can set them all on the counter over here where I can see them. Oh, and preheat the oven to 375.
Why can't I just take them out when you need them?
Because that's the way our teacher, Mr. Mabata, likes us to do it.
That doesn't make any sense. She pokes a finger into your apron just above the words, "Your opinion." Okay, okay. Open the pantry. What else is on the menu?
Shashuka.
God bless you.
Joseph, she rolls her eyes. It's the national dish of Israel.
About an hour later, you're looking at what remains of what you must admit was an impressive meal for a 10-year-old, even with your ineffectual help. The muffins were delicious, and the shashuka, a spicy egg, tomato, pepper, and cheese casserole, was much better than you thought it would be, despite the peppers, which are not your favorite.
That was a feast, Sandra. Maybe you should be a chef when you grow up.
No, she shakes her head. Not me.
Anyone can learn to cook, even you if you tried. I'm going to invent toys that make us $1 million. Then I'm going to buy an island in Florida or the Caribbean and build a castle that looks like a giant toy chest.
Okay, that sounds like a plan. What kind of toys?
Not the old-fashioned ones like Ninja Turtles or Play-Doh or Etch-a-Sketch. Toys that play with kids instead of kids playing with them.
She picks a crumble of feta from the remnants of the shashuka and pops it into her mouth.
And they'll be able to tell you things.
What kind of things? She's suddenly uncomfortable, as if she's said too much.
Just things.
She gets up from her chair.
Alexa things, like the capital of Wisconsin, or how many cups in a pint. Whatever you want to know.
Sandra reaches for your plate, scrapes the leftovers onto hers, and piles the two together. She's never cleared your plate before. Usually she has to be reminded to take her own. Something's bothering her. Scoop up the casserole dish and follow her into the kitchen. Do you have any homework, you ask?
The bottom chef has cleanup duty. I should probably read some of my book, she says without enthusiasm.
But she lingers while you put dishes in the dishwasher. Another anomaly.
Why is Daddy P mad at you? She says.
Keep working.
I don't think he's mad exactly. Not at me. At someone? Grandma?
He's like you. And me. Doesn't want to move.
But you do, Joseph. You pretend that you don't. But you really want to live with Grandma and her icky paintings.
It's complicated. You know, she's so sick.
She's dying. I asked Daddy P, and he said she was.
You feel a twinge. You should have been the one to tell her. Mother is your family. As the silence stretches, you feel a panicky urge to flee. If you were in the museum, you'd be stationed in front of one of the paintings, imagining yourself onto an alien world or galloping across the prairie to rescue settlers. It's not just about that, you say. It's about how we can afford to live here. I'm worried about my job. In that moment, being the dad hurts more than you can bear. You don't know how to do this.
You could get another job.
To your horror, you feel the hunter stir. But no, not the hunter you've known. He's changed self, even as you recoil from him. He's less desperate, more persuasive. Merritt and the Gathered claim it's no big deal to free Sandra from the useless illusion of self. It would be such a comfort to believe that.
I don't know who would hire me, Sandra, you say.
The not-hunter's mind is racing. The rest of Sandra's childhood with you doesn't have to be anything like yours was. If you take her now, you'd be her liberator, not just the dad. With the support and guidance of the Gathered, you can do right by her, raise a healthy, selfless daughter.
I guess that must be kind of scary for a grown-up.
Sandra is rocking back and forth, talking to her feet.
I don't want to move and leave Shanice and Emily and my school and all my friends. But if you say we have to move, then we maybe have to. As long as it means we can stay together. That's what I want most of all.
She's crying.
Maybe you want me to talk to Daddy P for you. I'll tell him I understand.
You're stunned by a wave of feeling you can't name. The narrator is at a loss. The feeling is familiar and odd at the same time, and it washes the last vestiges of the hunter away. The whole idea of hunting and taking. You were sick. You realize that now. Are sick. But here is the cure. Your brave little girl isn't thinking about taking anything from you. She wants to give you your life. No, it comes out as a moan. When you clutch Sandra to you, your arms are as stiff as 2x4s against her little body.
No, we're not moving. You've never been much of a hugger. Why is that? The feeling gets stronger, warmer. Maybe you need to pretend more. Fake it until you make it. You say,
I've just decided we're staying right here.
Maybe the gathered can help you. You decided me, sweetheart. You should see what they have to offer you, but keep them away from your family.
I'll take care of you, little girl.
I'm not little.
She wipes her face against your chest. But I love you, Daddy. Of course she does. Now, recognize that feeling, Joseph.
Hello, this is Jim Kelly, and yes, that was me narrating Selfless. If you enjoyed the reading, you might be interested in checking out the official Asimov's author and editor blog. It's called From Earth to the Stars. I just posted my thoughts on the difference between reading this story and listening to it, along with a brief reminiscence of my friend Gardner Dozois. That's FromEarthToTheStars.com, FromEarthToTheStars.com, all one word and no caps. Hope you like it.
Thanks for listening to Asimov's Spotlight, a feature of Asimov's Science Fiction Magazine. If you liked what you've heard, consider subscribing to Asimov's. We're available in print and digital. And please stop by again next month to hear another exciting story chosen from our pages.